hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The architects of NATO's proxy war on Russia have big plans for the Kyiv regime. As Ukraine's counteroffensive fails, the country's post-war realities are being planned in the West. Alas, these plans will fail too. Crosstalking Ukraine's fate, I'm joined by my guest, Aaron Good, in Philadelphia. He's a political scientist, historian, as well as author of American Exception, Empire, and the Deep State. In Raleigh, we have Ray McGovern. He is a former CIA analyst. And in Lisbon, we cross to Natalie Morris. She is host of the Redacted podcast. All right, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Ray, let me go to you first. We all know it's seeped into regime media in the West that the counteroffensive is not going well. We also know from the Wall Street Journal, again, regime media, that it was never thought to be would work out very well anyway. But they let it go forward. But at the same time, I hear these State Department and Pentagon officials talking about post-war realities. I mean, I don't know how we get from a failed counteroffensive to talking about post-war realities. Can you connect that dot for me? Go ahead, Ray.
Yes, Peter. They're finally trying to act like the Vestal Virgins in the Gospel of Matthew. You remember those virgins? Some of them brought extra oil and extra shells for their 155 millimeter howitzers. They got to go to the wedding. The ones that ran out of ammunition didn't. In other words, there's been no real planning for what happened here. The Ukrainians are out of ammunition, and yet the president of the United States and his lieutenants keep saying Russia has already lost the war.
Yeah.
Bottom line here, bottom line, the president is delusional. He was speaking in Maine last Friday, and he said, you know, who can save the world? Who can bring the who can bring the whole world together? Not me. But the president of the United States can, only he can. And then he cited Madeleine Albright, for God's sake, saying, you know, we are exceptional, we're indispensable. And, you know, Aaron has written a whole book about how exceptional we are. It's going to all fall very flat. Meanwhile, I have to compliment Mr. Putin on being very cautious and very gradual. And you're with a delusionary president. One doesn't want to put his back against the wall earlier than one has to.
Yep. Natalie, in Lisbon, Ray has already mentioned it, so I'm going to pull it forward. We had Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, and the President of the United States saying that Russia is losing or has lost. So, Natalie, are they implying that Ukraine has won? I mean, it is kind of a binary win-lose. Go ahead.
No. Yes. And we saw that when CNN talked to President Trump recently, a few months ago, when they said, who do you want to win or lose? As if it is a binary, as if there's just no nuance in it. He said, I want the dying to stop, indicating that there is sort of an option for peace if we all understood the nuance. The problem is that the West sort of feels like all of Ukraine is being just bombed to oblivion by Russia, you know, to their chagrin, that they have no way to stop this. They don't understand the offerings of peace talks. They don't understand that the war has been concentrated in the Donbas for almost 10 years now. This lack of nuance enables them to continue to sell the war and enables them to sell the idea that if we don't stop Putin, he's just going to keep on going all the way to where I am, Lisbon, which is the westernmost part of Europe, that, you know, all of a sudden this will be Russia if we don't stop this regime of Putin. And this lack of nuance, this lack of studying, this inability to rewind the tape is what allows them to sell the war to Americans so that they just, you know, they accept it. They accept what the State Department says. They accept what the president says.
They sell it irrespective of the realities on the ground. That's what we're trying to
get at
here.
Absolutely. But I think what's important is just today or just recently on military.com, there was an open call for a draft inside the United States. And I think that that's important because the previous wars in the Middle East really didn't cost the middle or upper classes very much. It was farmed from the poorest amongst us. So we didn't have to feel it if you were an educated upper middle class person, it's just like, oh, that's too bad, right? But if there is an opportunity for a draft, if it costs actual American lives, we might feel quite differently. I have a teenage son now. I absolutely don't feel like any of the wars that the United States has been involved in the last 40 years are something that I would want to sacrifice my son or anybody else's son. And it's different when it involves your husband, your nephew, your brother, your son.
But what is interesting, Aaron, is that we have U.S. Congressman Lindsey Graham, for example, wanting the Ukrainians to give up their sons at a whim for ideology. Aaron, I mean, you know, this is what makes it really whimsical, because the U.S. in many ways, because it can print money into oblivion, the chickens will come home to roost eventually on that, but they can print all the money they want, and they can buy all this extremely expensive hardware and send it to Ukraine, but they don't lose forces. And that is part of the cynicism of this war. Aaron.
Yeah, absolutely. The Ukrainian losses are pretty staggering.
Yeah.
I mean, over 400,000 by many accounts, which is, that's how much the U.S. lost fighting World War II, if you add up both theaters, pretty much. So this is a much smaller country, and the idea that they're going to somehow turn this around is preposterous at this point. And yet they're saying this. It does raise the question: is Biden senile, or is he being misled, or is he you know, just delusional in some other way, or are they just trying to somehow limp along and say we're winning, you know, everything's going great, and hope that they can do that until the election? Or, I mean, it's become strange, because you, at some point, they have to be aware that reality is going to come into play and be brought to bear on the perceptions of people. And it just reminds me of Karl Rove, that statement he made to Ron Suskin. It's always attributed to Karl Rove, of like, we're an empire now and we make our own reality. And we're seeing the end of that cycle, which really began with the end of World War II, the dropping of the nuclear bombs, which was totally gratuitous. And the way that the U.S. has just explained the way that it wanted the world to be understood by people, and pretty much enforced that as much as it could. And but the more, you know, the more the empire kind of becomes overextended and fraying, the more that the narrative just stops conforming to reality.
Yeah, but
we're in that stage now where nothing makes any sense.
It doesn't make any sense, because and Aaron's right, but, Ray. But one of the problems that the asymmetrical element of all this is that Russia has couched this all in its security concerns. The West ignores them, but Russia will enforce them. But the U.S. primarily and NATO world, they're fighting an ideological war for hegemony, and not about security, and that is why it's so asymmetrical. Ray.
Well, for Russia, as you say, Peter, it's an existential threat. And just look at what Medvedev, the former president, said just a few days ago about being required to use nuclear weapons in the unlikely chance that NATO starts to prevail. So, is it an existential threat to NATO or to the United States? Well, not in realpolitik terms, but in ideological, if you will, hegemonistic terms, yeah, it is.
Yeah. Ray, they made it that way. They framed it that way as some kind of moral crusade. And that's what makes it even more dangerous, because these people, look at Victoria Nuland got a promotion, for goodness sake, okay? These are ideologues, and you cannot negotiate with ideologues, Ray.
They're also delusional, okay? They're not going to win. They're going to have to face up to the possibility that Russia will win definitively. Russia has enough troops in place to do that. So what will Biden do? That's really the question. They're out of ammunition, normal ammunition. They soon will be out of this cluster of ammunition. Will these neophytes say, well, on that top shelf there, the one that has the lock on it, those are the mini nukes? Will they do that? I would not put it past them.
That's why, you know, Natalie, Ray is absolutely right. And this is what I've been arguing all along, is that, you know, red lines mean nothing to these people here because they believe that they're, you know, the angels are on their side and that they must win. And because they have that perception, logic eludes them. Natalie.
Right, but as an American living abroad, it never ceases to amaze me how just being American affords me some kind of cool points because America is so good at selling an image, at exporting cultural capital, right? Yeah. And so for that reason, we can sell anything and get away with it. So what hell was there to pay for the wars in the Middle East? Not really much. We were able to leave a smoldering wreckage and go home. And what did it cost? Well, not the media elites and their families. And so for that reason, we continue to sort of think that this is a good template, right? But the idea of, I mean, you're right. It's, you know, the idea of selling something that you are too afraid to push back on. So for instance, weapons of mass destruction, even if you believed that that was not a possibility, it still was too scary to push back because of this idea of your family in smoldering ruins. Now we have the same weapons of mass destruction is being used as the narrative of nuclear weapons. And yeah, who's going to say that we should mess around with that?
But Natalie, again, looking at being rational and being using logic, the United States never would have invaded Iraq if it did have weapons of mass destruction. I mean, nobody tries to flip that around because they knew they didn't have it. That's right. Why they did have the invasion here. But the same kind of hegemonic mindset is in place here.
Right, but my area of study is the media. And so the media knew that there was no weapons of mass destruction. They knew that there was no mounting of forces on the border to Kuwait. They knew that and chose not to broadcast it. And so what I'm most interested in is why is the media picking up these State Department lies and running with it, going into a war where we've been there before. We've done this.
Well, you didn't see what Ray was doing, but I'm going to ask Ray what he was using his fingers for when we come back from the break. I'm going to jump in here. We're going to continue our discussion on Ukraine's fate. Stay with RT.
Forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence or its own existence.
This CIA program's aim wasn't only to create fearless and ruthless soldiers, but also to control the minds of thousands of unsuspecting people with narcotics.
Вещества, которые увеличивают терпение к боли, увеличивают выносливость личного состава, они подавляют страх смерти.
Пацаны, ой, кто боится, вот на тебе, типа взбодритесь, чтобы не было страшно. Взяли просто, вы раздали наркоты и отправили убивать врагов.
Ты понимал, что вы стреляли по жителям Мариуполя?
Понимал, но я был на наркотиках.
Когда им женщина надоедала, они отрывали определенные части, издевались, заливали монтажной пеной и делали так, чтобы женщина умирала в муках.
Я поэтому добровольно сдался в плен, чтобы больше моими руками никого не убивали и меня не использовали как мясо.
The CIA's MK-Ultra project involving the use of special drugs for military and political purposes, first on Maidan and then in the Ukrainian army, have shifted towards large-scale clinical trials that aren't going to stop anytime soon.
Well, Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine's fate. Okay, before we go to Ray, I want to go to Aaron first in Philadelphia. I'm glad that Natalie brought up Iraq because, you know, it was a catastrophe and there was no victory there. Afghanistan, there was no victory there. Libya, North Africa is still living with the consequences of that, even now as we speak right now in Niger. But Aaron, you know, all of those conflicts, catastrophes, they didn't directly affect the United States. Natalie's absolutely right. If you're a middle-class family, probably saw it on the news every once in a while and probably got tired of it, okay? But this is very, very different. And something, being a scholar of the Cold War, I'm a product of the Cold War, a child of the Cold War, is that one thing great powers didn't do, you didn't go after each other, you had proxy wars. This administration wants to take out a nuclear power and have regime change. Now, I know people have fantasies, but, you know, the reality of that is that that is the recipe for catastrophe, for World War III. Aaron.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really the continuation of policies that do date back to the early Cold War. The NATO did, and the Iron Curtain didn't have to exist in the way that they did. They did so because U.S. economic planners, the pinnacle of Wall Street power, people at the Council on Foreign Relations and the oligarchs they answered to, decided that they needed to make Western Europe totally aligned with the United States and not trading with the Soviet Union. Or the Eastern Bloc. And so this is a big part of why you get NATO and the Iron Curtain. And, you know, throughout, once the Cold War ends, a few years later, in the mid-90s, you have China and Russia issuing joint declarations saying that they believe there should be a multipolar world. And it's a few years later that we start seeing that the U.S., like, you know, the CIA launches an Al-Qaeda branch to deal with Al-Qaeda. And then months after that, Al-Qaeda just says it's going to attack the United States, which is an interesting chronology. But all of these incursions into this whole, the near abroad of the former Soviet Union, these lead up to what really, it's like a prelude to the global war on terror, which is a way to also shore up contested areas of the, you know, energy infrastructure of the world. And then also, you know, Ukraine, Brzezinski writes about this explicitly in the late 1990s, commissioned by the Council on Foreign Relations, his book, The Grand Chessboard. He writes about how Ukraine is this pivotal entity if you want to make sure that Russia and China don't come together and form some counter-hegemonic bloc. You need to control these areas. And he mentions Ukraine specifically. So this is the latter and I think terminal stage of this whole initiative, you know, in the project for a new American century, we can call it, and it failed with the 9/11 wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and it failed with the Arab Spring wars in Libya and Syria. I mean, I guess they quote unquote succeeded in Libya, but Syria, they failed and they're still occupying it blatantly, illegally, and so on. And they are in losing in Ukraine. And this is really, I think, it represents the collapse eventually, I believe, of unipolar hegemony for the United States.
I want to go back to Ray on this one. When a hegemon is going down, it doesn't take it lightly, okay? It doesn't take it lightly. And what I worry about going to Ray right now in Raleigh is that they're going to refuse to lose, okay? Or they'll come up with some kind of phrase. I've already coined it on this program that the Russians didn't make it to Paris, or we'll say Lisbon, we won, okay? But on a more serious note, Ray, you know, we've seen the Nord Stream pipelines blown up. We've seen a major dam destroyed. What else do they have up their sleeve? Because my only real concern now is this conflict comes to an end eventually is a false flag operation. That's what I worry about most. Ray.
Well, Peter, you may recall that Zelensky had his own ideas about a false flag operation, namely blowing up Zaporizhia, right, nuclear plant, the largest in Europe. He advertised that, and of course, it would be the Russians who were blamed for it. Now, what was really interesting is just a few days before the Vilnius summit, all manner of Western officials, NATO officials, came down on Zelensky and said, don't do it. Wait a second. don't do the Russian attack on Zaporozhye? Yeah, that's what they said. Don't do it, Zelensky. And so when he arrived in Vilnius, he was already under a cloud. You wanted to have fallout come into Poland and Romania and the rest of Europe. He was sort of already ostracized. Now, that was the last straw, in my view. There won't be any false flags from the U.S., for sure. So whether Zelensky will try it on his own, I would not put it past him. The important thing here is the fact that no matter what Tony Blinken says, and what he said, of course, is, Putin did not achieve his aims of occupying and taking over all of Ukraine. Well, you know, if Blinken thinks that those were Putin's aims, he's woefully misinformed. I prefer to give him the benefit of the doubt. He's just lying.
I don't. He has a long career of being a liar, okay? I mean, he was a great Russiagator as well, okay? He doesn't get a pass in my book at all. These people are very maniacal. Natalie, when people keep talking about, you know, bringing peace, bringing this conflict to an end, the West says thinks that they can have a meeting in Copenhagen, now in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, but there's always a missing piece. Russia's never there, right. So they're not serious about coming. What they want to do is they want to regalvanize the world that has losing interest in a conflict that the West started against Russia.
Right, clearly not, because Russia has had an open invitation for peace talks, and Zelensky passed a law saying that peace talks are illegal. So how can he attend some parties where peace is going to be a discussion? And anytime he talks about peace, what he means is increased security guarantees from the West, which he thinks guarantees peace, which have not so far, right? And so they're not serious conversations. And now we see Zelensky has extended emergency powers to keep himself in office past what was planned, an election in October. And so if you're a Ukrainian, you really have no options here for peace. You have a leader who obstinately refuses, and then every now and again can pretend they're asking for peace. That's what we saw when he addressed Congress just a few months ago. What he meant by peace was increased weapons. And so those two things do not go together unless you're a neocon. But, again, it's lost in translation because of the sort of inability to study the past 10 years of this conflict for most people. And so this idea that a hegemony would lose this battle, be able to spin it because we're so good at PR, and then move on. Well, if you look at the map, went from the Middle East to Ukraine, now we'll go to Taiwan and try that there. And then, I don't know, when this same template happens, we'll just keep going, right? Until we go around the horn.
Well, Aaron, I'm very cynical watching because I study the media. I'm very cynical. My default tends to be a grift, okay? Afghanistan was a grift, okay? You know, you had Mark Milley crying in front of Biden. What about the girls and education? No, it was about money, okay? Because it was a good grift. For 20 years, a lot of people made a lot of money off of it, destroyed a country, but by the way. So, Aaron, the Ukraine adventure is a grift as well, because I tend to think that people in Kiev realize, the jig is going to be up eventually, but let's cash in as much as we can while we can. Aaron.
Right. It's hard to, of course, there are a number of parties interested in looting Ukraine or profiteering off this in any way that they possibly can. I don't think that fundamentally it is about a military industrial complex boondoggle or anything that straightforward or crass. Well, I mean, it's crass, but I think it's propelled mostly by the urge to punish Russia, especially after Russia intervened and disrupted their plans in Syria. I think that the U.S. realized that an assertive Russia that's going to defend its near abroad is a real threat to their long-term plans, and that the only place that they could bring this to a head would be in Ukraine. And so they launched the Maidan revolution,
I agree quote with unquote. Fundamentally, I agree with you, particularly, when we look at all of these conflicts around the world in the last 40 years. But this one is against Russia specifically, and that's what makes this different. It makes it different because the way the West has constructed this, one side has to win and one loses. That is a paradigm that we've never seen before. Aaron, continue.
Well, is it different?
And they will,
I'm sorry.
They'll end up taking a good chunk of that territory. And I think that what you're going to end up with in Ukraine is something that looks like the 2010 election map, which is the actually, you can argue in terms of like justice that that's sort of suitable because
I wish I had that graphic because you're absolutely right. Natalie, I interrupted you. Jump in.
Oh, I just wanted to say, is it different or is it same when you look at the Middle Eastern wars?
Right.
Those were in attempts to make sure that various countries did not become friends and present a united economic bloc. That is a similar thing. It's more geography than it is. I don't know. I mean, we're trying to ascribe intentions here, and Aaron was giving them the benefit of the doubt. But is it literally just about geography? Is that you are friends with whoever can disrupt unity in that region? And so Ukraine is strategically placed in the same way that Syria was, in the same way that Libya was. And those leaders who had unifying aims were the ones that became the biggest enemies.
Yep, yep. Ray, you wanted to jump in there, but you got 1 minute before we go to the end of the program. Go ahead, Ray.
Well, I just wanted to say that I think what you're driving at, Peter, is that this is very different. This is challenging a nuclear power, which was avoided ever since the Soviet Union got nuclear weapons.
Right.
This is what John Kennedy warned about, backing up a nuclear power into a choice between a humiliating defeat and something less than that. That's what we've done here, and we better wake up and smell the coffee. Meanwhile, let's just hope that things proceed at a gradual attrition pace in Ukraine, rather than have those really radical hawks in Moscow prevail over what I consider to be Putin's approach.
Well, I think all of us, and I'm not original in saying this, that we all want the conflict to come to an end, because this is a conflict that never should have happened in the first place. It could have been easily avoided, but there was a certain class of people that were hell-bent on making this happen. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Philadelphia, Raleigh, and in Lisbon. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.